On this week's 51%, we speak with the author of a book of voices from the illegal abortion era.
It just seemed looming that we are once again about to go back to the possibility of not being able federally to secure a safe medical procedure that is between a woman and her doctor.
Two kids from Syria talk about their country at war, and we bring you an essay called Invisible. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
I'm my brother's keeper every chance I can. And I pay my taxes like any working man. And I feel I've earned my right to choose. You don't get play God.
Back Rooms, Voices from the Illegal Abortion Era, has been republished. It's the book's fourth publication, and Kingston, New York-based Ellen Messer is the author. I asked her why she reissued the book.
In 1988, the times were very different. The reason that it was published at that time and the thought for it was how before 73, it was, of course, illegal federally, and difficult to get an abortion. It was all a criminal act. But by the time Roe v. Wade passed in 73, it felt like women who wanted or needed or chose to have an abortion before that were criminals, and the next day they could go to any health clinic, many OBGYNs, and ask for that procedure. And it was legal to do. So one day they were criminals, and the next they were seeking a safe medical procedure. And the dichotomy was so startling to me that it felt like I needed to work on creating a sense of how difficult it was to live in an era when taking care of one's own reproductive health and needs were considered criminal. So the stark difference urged me to write about women whose experiences were not only abortion, that's just one piece of it, but how unwanted, unplanned pregnancies deeply impacted the lives of men and women in so many ways. Well, that seemed to be just fine, thank you, in terms of legislation, although states had consistently edged away at the regulations and shifted the ability for women to get abortions. However, now it seemed, although this is not a book about politics, it just seemed looming that we are once again about to go back to the possibility of not being able federally to secure a safe medical procedure that is between a woman and her doctor. And it seemed like the right time to republish.
You know, I think we should point out that the actual republication occurred just before the November election.
It did happen before, but the nature of the country, you could feel that there were so many changes that were impending. Individual states were making it more difficult. There were issues in Texas, issues in a number of southern states that made it apparent that the tenor of the country was shifting, and it felt like that could be an issue, as well as a Supreme Court justice coming up for approval. So put all that together, and it just seemed timely, whether Trump was or wasn't yet elected as a president. And I think that the importance is that it speaks to the reproductive health and the freedom of women. And it's the very freedom of who we are as 51% that's threatened now. And those threats are looming, the Supreme Court and decisions that could be made there, decisions about birth control, decisions about affordable health care. There are so many things, yes, the word is stunning, that are happening that it's a very appropriate time for people to take a look at what we could go back to, which is a very unpleasant thought.
How realistic is this possibility?
I think that I would hate to see it happen, but it is possible. Defunding Planned Parenthood makes access even more difficult in a number of states. Of course, it's a possibility. I hate to think it's a real event that would happen, but it is a possibility. And to me, that's sort of like being back in at least the late 60s, before that, the 50s. California was the first state under Reagan, as a matter of fact, to have legal abortions. New York followed before Roe v. Wade. But I'd hate to think that it was up to individual states to make those decisions, because women will certainly suffer, and men. What affects women affects men, of course. In the book, women are interviewed who talk about things that kids nowadays never even heard of, such as shotgun weddings, when they decided that it would be a shame for a woman not to be married and raise a child. So the man and woman both were forced into a wedding that most likely had not been planned or wanted, and that's not a good way to start a marriage. Or women who did not have the cooperation or did not want to marry the father of the child could choose to have a child out of wedlock. And frequently, these women went to a different place, got themselves a job, and talked about how the father had been killed in one sort or another of an industrial accident, or was off at in the army and chose to raise the child by herself. And there were other women who gave up children for adoption. And those were the interviews that were really the hardest to get and the hardest to listen to. The book also talks about doctors who helped, activists who were helping women before Roe v. Wade, and who also did a lot of work politically to convince the public to help make statements that would encourage lawmakers to have abortions be legal. So it was a very active time before 73. And that's the one thing that I could say I also see mirrored, is that suddenly we've become active again.
Do you envision a day in your lifetime when women have all their reproductive rights, that this is not an issue anymore?
Well, no, I don't think so, because it's not just women, it's men. If it were only women, the women who would choose to terminate pregnancies because of a myriad of reasons would have the freedom to do so. But if the men in power are still legislating, or the women do not have the freedom, or don't forget, there's certainly a religious component as well. And if that's where men who are making legislation are coming from, women will never be fully free, those of us who might want to be. And for the other women, that's what they're choosing to do as well. It's how people approach the law. Of course, it could be a private issue between a woman and her doctor, which was the whole point. But it's taken that privacy and made it public.
What has been the reception to the book?
The reception's been terrific. Every review has been as good as the initial reviews, as the New York Times reviewed it in there was Sunday Book Review back in 88 when it was released. Everybody is on board with how important the stories are and how pertinent they are to having our freedoms. It's important to remember, on the other hand, that it's almost speaking to the choir, because the people who have read the book for the most part are not people who would be empathetic to the reasons why abortion should be illegal. And it's interesting, because you're right about the fact that it comes out of the issue of privacy. It says, no, you can't even be private. You can't do what you want. And besides, we're imposing on you the belief that a fetus has rights like any other human being, and therefore you're committing murder. And I think that's at the crux of it, that not having those freedoms is not just so much about a woman not having the freedom to deal with what she wants to do with her body, but that now she is a breeder of a human being, and that human being from conception has rights, and those rights are being impinged if you terminate a pregnancy. And that's sort of the old argument for why not have birth control. Every, you know, egg has a possibility of becoming a human, and every sperm has a possibility of fertilizing an egg that becomes a human. So don't stop that process either. And that takes away individual rights completely. And it's something that women and men both are having to deal with and will have to deal with if this administration decides one way or another to make those laws incredibly different than the way they've been for the last 35, 40 years, actually, for the last 40 years.
Ellen, have you received threats?
Not this time around yet, thank you very much. The first time I did, actually, the first time I did through the initial publisher, St. Martin's, I went to Bill Baird. Bill Baird was a real pioneer and a showman who used to go out in a kind of microbus touting birth control. He wasn't even working with anything that terminated pregnancies, just birth control itself, because there was a time, you know, that that was illegal too in a number of contexts. So he would go out in this bus and he would show young women birth control pills, but he would do it in a very flamboyant way. And I went to interview him about what his experience had been and what he did and how he got arrested and so forth. And he said to me, you have to be careful. If you have an envelope that comes to you that has fingerprints on it, or it has smudges, or it's written in strange letters that are cut out from magazines. Well, I did get a letter like that. And it was filled with hate mail. He was concerned that it could be a letter bomb, but it was definitely filled with hate mail and horrible pictures and nasty words. And so that kind of thing, yeah, I've had that. I had that the first time around.
Ellen, I don't mean this in a rude way, but if you are, as you said earlier, preaching to the choir with this book, why reissue it?
You know, it's a book of saying. It's also, if you think about it, not just that, Allison, it's also about helping women to really see why their activism is so important. Even those women who have been through it and were through it years and years ago and are no longer of childbearing age, they have children, they've got daughters, they've got granddaughters. They understand what it was like and want their children and grandchildren to understand what it was like. And I think that becomes all the more poignant and lets men and women know what we're really fighting for, what we want to keep, what we don't want to let go of, what we don't want to go back to. So yes, it's preaching to the choir, as I said, it's a lot of people who already know, but then acquainting these young women who have no idea what it was like, and really it's an impetus to say, no, I don't want to go back there. I don't want to live like that. That's not how I want to be. That's not how I want my friends and family to be. We're worth much more than that in terms of making our own decisions and each one of us finding our own ground, our own ethical ground.
That was Ellen Messer, author of Back Rooms, Voices from the Illegal Abortion Era, which recently was republished. The Syrian war marked a grim anniversary in March when the conflict entered its seventh year. That's enough time for a generation of children to grow up knowing no other Syria than the one at war. UNICEF issued a report on this anniversary, saying the suffering of children they recorded in Syria reached unprecedented levels in 2016. More than 650 were killed, and nearly the same number injured. We're about to hear from two children whose country has been at war for most of their lives.
Ella is 9 years old. She's in the second grade. 5 years ago, she had to flee Aleppo with her family.
I was playing with my brothers and sisters. All of a sudden, the power went out and the shelling grew stronger. We were so scared. We hid in the bathroom. Everything was shaking. We were so frightened. We hugged our mother.
Ella told UNICEF how she escaped through the battle-torn streets of the city.
I took nothing from home with me because the noise, the shelling, was getting louder and louder all the time. We couldn't take anything, not my doll or my best dress. On the street I saw fire and smoke and people running and people who were injured, even a girl who got separated from her parents.
For 5 years now, the girl has lived in Tartus, a city on the Mediterranean which is controlled by the government. Ella and her family are among the 6.3 million Syrians who've fled the war's violence but remain in the country. German psychotherapist Elise Bittenbinder has worked with children and adolescents from crisis regions for 25 years. She says while people normally process their fears and integrate past traumas into their lives, some suffer the effects much longer.
It's common for these children to develop certain symptoms like headaches, sleep disorders, difficulties concentrating or bedwetting. Or they have what we call flashbacks. They don't know where they are, or if they're experiencing the traumatic situation again.
According to UNICEF, the situation for Syrian children was the worst it's ever been last year. At least 652 were killed, a fifth more than the year before. Almost half of them were killed while at school or near a school. And more children are being recruited to fight on the front lines. Millions of Syrian children can no longer lead anything resembling a normal life.
My name is Mahmoud. I'm 11 years old. I'm in the fourth grade. For 5 years, I didn't go to school after second grade. That's when the schools closed because of the war.
Mahmoud lives in eastern Aleppo. After government-aligned troops recaptured the former rebel stronghold in December, he's been able to go to school again.
We were under siege, under bombardment, and we couldn't go outside. The thing I'm most afraid of is that I'll be separated from my siblings or that they'll get hurt. My father was injured 8 months ago. We were so sad.
Constant threat and trauma can take a high toll on children in war zones. Psychotherapist Bittenbinder says if children who have intense traumatic symptoms don't get the help they need, it can become chronic.
We know that symptoms of trauma can last a lifetime and sometimes even be passed on to the next generation.
As well as the long-term concerns for the Syrians growing up knowing only war in their country, there are pressing immediate needs. UNICEF is especially worried about the estimated 2.8 million children who live in regions which aid workers have great difficulty accessing. 280,000 children live in besieged areas. They're all but completely cut off from humanitarian aid, the organisation says. UNICEF demands that the warring parties find a political solution to the conflict immediately and refrain from any sort of violation against children. Bittenbinder says children who have been through war need prospects for their future.
Think about what happened in Germany after the Second World War. There were many traumatized people, children and adults. What helped them was the mutual feeling of now we are rebuilding the country, and the subsequent economic boom helped people focus on new things.
Mahmoud, the 11-year-old from eastern Aleppo, has this message for others his age.
I tell all the children, come back to school and study so you can make your dreams come true.
We'd like to thank Deutsche Welle Radio's World Link program for providing content for this segment, which was produced by Samantha Early, Neil King, and Karsten Kuntop. And now we close our show with an essay from writer Dr. Jerry Burns.
My husband and I were hooked on a science fiction series called Continuum, which is a philosophical action story with technological magic from the future. Sounds cool, huh? The leading character wore a smart suit that performed many tricks. When she zipped it up, both suit and woman were invisible. unseen, she sneaked in and out of the action. She committed surprise attacks during fight scenes. She also secretly attended meetings to gather intelligence. Invisible to the eye, everyone talked over and around her, but never to her. And she heard everything. It's titillating to think about what can happen if we're invisible and make our way through the world. But it's only fun when invisibility is a choice. Some people are invisible against their will. Imagine this scene. You go to the mall with two friends and shop for a badly needed winter coat. You wait in line at the cash register and the cashier says, "Hi," and takes the coat. Then he gazes above your head, looks at your companions, and asks them personal questions. About you. He tries to engage them in a conversation. About you. His conversation happens over your head and all around you as if you're not there. As if you were a sci-fi character gathering intelligence while wearing a futuristic invisibility suit. How would you feel? This situation happened to a young woman I know. She's disabled and cannot walk unaided. Sometimes she uses a cane, but that day, like many others, she was in her wheelchair. When she got on the checkout line, she was thrilled because she found the perfect winter coat just in time before the cold blast hit. And when she got off that checkout line, she was angry, upset, and hurt, feeling as though a different blast hit. This is what she says about the situation. "Why would you ask someone else what is wrong with me? Am I just someone to be looked down upon because I have to use a wheelchair? Why wouldn't the guy ask me what is wrong with me?" These are excellent questions. Perhaps the cashier made a clumsy attempt at a caring gesture, or maybe he wrongfully thought it was all right to ask personal questions about a complete stranger. But just because a wheelchair is in plain view, it doesn't mean that the reason it's needed should also be in plain view. And more to the point, if he wanted to know so badly, why didn't he just ask her? The young woman doesn't understand why she couldn't be spoken to directly. She may not be ambulatory, but that doesn't mean she can't communicate. I find it ironic and strange that an unmistakable and unsubtle thing as a wheelchair causes some people to forget that there's a person inside it, a whole person with feelings and a beating heart. Maybe this happened the way it did because as a society, we are in the unfortunate habit of not noticing disabled people. As children, we're taught to not stare. We are trained to not notice. And so, in our efforts to not stare and not notice, we often look over the heads of those we pretend not to see. I'm sad to say that this young woman's experience is not an isolated incident wrought from one person's ignorance. People in the disability community experience this all the time. Another friend, who uses crutches, tells me that people often grab the door while she's in the middle of opening it. In their efforts to help, they almost knock her down. She knows they mean well, but frets about how rare it is that anyone ever asks, "How can I help you?" and not assume that they know what's best for her. We live in an ableist society, which means that life is geared for able-bodied people, and discrimination occurs against people with disabilities. Without federal laws to mandate access for all, we might blunder forth completely blind to others' rights and needs. Yet even with those laws, able-bodied people are often in need of more assistance. We need to combat our ableism and treat people with disabilities as people. My friend is a person who wants to be spoken to, whether she's using her cane, standing up, or sitting in a wheelchair. She's real. She is a person who deserves to be treated with dignity. And unless we make her so, she is not invisible.
Dr. Jerry Burns is a storyteller, writer, and educator living in New York's Hudson Valley. You can find her at storycrafters.com. She also is an adjunct professor in the Department of Communication at the State University of New York at New Paltz. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1445.